It came as a result of the position of leadership which was imposed upon us by the God of heaven, who brought forth a restoration of the gospel of Jesus Christ. And when the declaration was made concerning the only true and living church upon the face of the earth, we were immediately put in a position of loneliness, the loneliness of leadership, from which we cannot shrink nor run away, and to which we must face up with boldness and courage and ability.
This is the Leading LDS Podcast. My name is Kurt Frankum, and we are here to talk leadership. Before we jump into the interview, I definitely want to welcome those that are new to the Leading LDS community. I recorded this episode at the end of March of 2015, and Leading LDS smashed its records last week by having over 23,000 visitors in a three-day time period. Many of those visitors signed on to the Leading LDS community, which anybody can do at leadinglds.com at the top of the page. So we welcome the new ears that are listening, and we hope you benefit from the content shared here. Now, onto the episode. I interviewed Steve Willis. Not only has Steve served as a bishop, branch president, member of his state presidency, and young men's president, which is his current calling, he also works in his day job as the vice president of professional services for Vital Smarts. If you don't know who Vital Smarts is, Steve will explain that in the interview. I love Vital Smarts because of their legendary books, most namely Influencer, Crucial Conversations, and Change Anything. Check these books out if you haven't already. They have influenced my leadership and had a huge impact on the confidence I've been able to carry as a leader. So here is my interview with Steve Willis. So I've got Steve Willis on the phone with me in Utah County. And are you right there in Provo, would you say, Steve?
I am right here in Provo. Currently, I'm in my office, which is right at the mouth of a canyon.
Wow. Beautiful.
Yeah, looking right out at Mount Temp, and the snow's quickly disappearing as the sky gets bluer and bluer behind it.
Nice. Steve, well, now tell me, what, you work for Vital Smarts, is that right?
That's right. I'm the vice president of professional services at Vital Smarts, and I've been here for about 20 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
You sound like you're 20. You wish, right?
One time. It's been really interesting. It's been a lot of great opportunities to work around the country and around the world on different types of consulting and training programs. But, it seems just yesterday that I started, except that I know that it wasn't. My knees tell me it wasn't.
Yeah. So I'm sort of a fanboy of Vital Smarts. It sounds weird. And so I could probably tell it, I probably know all things about Vital Smarts, feels like, you know, they're sort of my, I don't listen to music or follow bands. I like follow strange leadership development companies. That's just the weirdo I am. So, I know a lot about Vital Smarts, but maybe as if I don't know, which many people listening probably don't know, what is Vital Smarts?
Well, we're a training and consulting firm, and we work in the space of organizational development, organizational behavior, and we've been focused on behavior change over the last number of years. So that means that we're going into organizations and working with teams and individuals and groups, divisions, whole companies, and trying to help them identify those behaviors which would accelerate their progress towards desired goals. So sometimes that's interpersonal communication behaviors. Sometimes it's problem solving behaviors. Sometimes it's performance management behaviors or teamwork behaviors. And we do mostly training, you know, two-day, one-day sessions where people are in a classroom to focus in on the ins and outs of those behaviors and how you learn to implement them, practice them, so that you'll be more capable when you get back to your job Monday morning, 8 a.m. We have a couple of programs that also are kind of overarching. How do you get people to adopt a new behavior? So not only what are the behaviors that they ought to be focused on, but once you've identified a behavior, how do you get people to change their current behaviors to adopt the new high leverage ones?
In other words, you're talking about home teaching, right? Nice, nice. Well, before we delve too much into that, tell us a little bit about yourself. What's your background? Obviously, you have an LDS background. Where were you raised? Where are you at in life? That type of thing.
Yeah. So as I mentioned, we currently live here in Provo. My wife and I, we have three boys who live just south of Center Street in the old Mazur neighborhood. We've been there for quite a while. Prior to that, we were at BYU and doing the student thing. I came to BYU from Reno, Nevada, where I spent most of my high school teenage years. And then from about 1 to 12, I was in California, Bay Area.
Cool.
So that was kind of fun. And then way, way back, born in Arizona, in Tucson.
Wow. Nice. And so you've been in Utah those 20 years then? You've been for Vital Sports or since BYU? Or?
I've been here since BYU, so it would actually be a little bit longer if we're thinking about since BYU. But 20 years here with Vital Smarts, yeah.
Okay, okay. And did you serve a mission?
I did. I was in Quito, Ecuador.
Right on.
That was from 90 to 92.
Wow, right on. And then got married, and now do you have kids or living the typical Mormon dream?
Yeah. We've got three boys. I've got a senior in high school, a freshman in high school, and a fifth grader.
Wow. Cool. Right on. And what sort of leadership experience have you had, maybe both in and out of the church, or primarily, I guess, focused in the church? You mentioned prior to the interview, you've served in some bishoprics and such. But
Yeah. So I've had a lot of opportunities to serve in different capacities in the church. Right now, I'm serving as the young men's president.
Oh, great.
But I've had an opportunity to be Sunday school teacher, gospel doctrine teacher, was the ward mission leader at one point. I've been a branch president, bishop. I was in the stake presidency for a while. had a lot of really interesting. I was a family home evening coordinator.
Nice.
BYU. Yeah.
Cool.
So, yeah, a couple of different interesting types of callings that
great.
People can see.
Yeah, so I would imagine you've seen, been around the block a few times and interacted with some interesting experiences. What I want to do in this interview, obviously, I really want to focus on your experience being a leader, what it was like, you know, what was hard for you, how'd you overcome those things, but also applying some of the Vital Smarts principles. And I've talked about them a lot on Leading LDS, but you know, there's various books you put out there, and obviously then you do the consulting and trainings for, I guess, primarily your realm is the professional services. So I would imagine you're working with a lot of companies, right?
That's right. And now I am over the professional services that we offer in our organization. So less about professional services such as law or tax that I'm working with. So I get to work with manufacturing, service industries, healthcare, but I work with the groups here inside that do some more of the consultative types of approaches.
Gotcha.
So take our programs and say, hey, how can we wrestle this issue to the ground amongst our leadership team? Those are a lot of the things that I do.
Okay, cool. So just looking back over your time, you know, serving in various capacities in the church, what have you taken away from the Vital Smarts principles most and applied? What's been most applicable for you?
Well, at Vital Smarts, we have this idea called a vital behavior, right? So if you're trying to accomplish some outcome, some goal, achieve some result, you need to take a step back and say, what actions or behaviors can people take that will drive that result? And you can usually come up with a big list of, you know, things that people can do, but there's typically on that list a handful of items that are higher leverage, right, that have a disproportionate impact on your ability to achieve that result. And so being able to figure out what those are is helpful for a leader or an individual, because then you're able to focus, right? You're not focusing on a list of 20 things to do. You're focusing on a list of 3 things to do, for example. We call those vital behaviors. So, for example, in the church, if you're thinking about church membership, there's a couple of things that you hear all the time, emphasized, reemphasized again and again in all kinds of different form. And one of those things is reading your scriptures daily. Another one of those things is prayer. And another one that we hear is temple attendance. And these are really impactful because they're personal, spiritual types of activities that really put you in the path of the Spirit in a way that other activities might not do so plainly. It doesn't mean that the other ones aren't helpful or important, just that if you start to do these three things consistently, they're almost like catalysts for other actions, for service, for love, for care, for help and concern. I mean, all of those other things kind of get their boost from these three cores. So if you're focusing on those, and you'll see that many of our leaders are asking those questions already because they know that the focus on those allows people to achieve greater spirituality, improve their testimony, right? Keep their covenants, which are all things that we care about.
Yeah. You know, I love this concept of vital behaviors. I remember the first book I picked up from the Vital Smarts organization was Influencer. And I remember this was early in the first couple of chapters of the book when it talks about this. And a lot of people will mix up vital behaviors. And I remember in the book, it uses the example of losing weight. And you go up to somebody and say, hey, how can you lose weight? And they say, oh, well, I got to eat better. I got to, eat less calories and exercise. And those seem like logical, like a good answer. But what people don't realize is that you don't have control over 100% of that activity, right? You don't know what do you do in those crucial moments when somebody starts passing out dessert at a party or those types of things, or you can't just say, well, I'm just going to eat better, right? But if you can say, and I think in the research they reference in Influencer talks about three things, and sometimes I don't remember them all, but one of those things, I guess it was three things that people did over a 6-year period of time that kept weight off, right? And one of them was they stepped on a scale every day. I think another one was they worked out at home. And I think the last one was they ate breakfast or something. But so it's not that that magically by stepping on a scale, weight just falls off, but it changes your paradigm when you do that, right? If you do that every day, it keeps reminding you that, hey, I should probably not eat that Twinkie during lunchtime because I remember when I stepped on that scale, right? So like you said, it's like a catalyst for other behaviors that will topple that that goal or topple that the mission to overcome your weight problem. And I remember in the realm of leadership, sometimes and I don't mean to go on and on here, but like you said, it creates focus. And I remember being a leader where you're just hustling, right? You're just doing everything you can think of. And I remember being an Elders Quorum president, just hustling like, okay, I've got to talk about home teaching. I got to push them. I got to show them the number, and do everything possible. And it seemed like I didn't have any focus on what I was doing. And so when I became high priest group leader, I said, I can't make these people home teach, but there's one thing I can do. I can meet with each individual once a month. And so I just did that, and I saw the home teaching numbers go up. It wasn't that I did the home teaching or that I magically, influenced them to do home teaching, but that constant accountability caused them to want to home teach and knowing that they'd see me the next month and be asked about home teaching and those types of things. So I think it's such – I love that the principle of vital behaviors, and but I think it's easily confused. Is that right?
Yeah, and just because – you understand what the vital behavior is doesn't always mean that it's easy to do.
Yeah.
Right. Some of them are obvious, but difficult, right? Like you were talking about. And so I think that's also one of the valuable ideas is if you understand what behavior you want, then it also helps you to focus on how do I influence that behavior? Yeah. Right? Yeah. Instead of doing it for them, like you would maybe as an Elders Quorum president, go out and visit people who didn't get visited by their home teacher. Say, now, how do I influence somebody to engage in that behavior, which seems so routine, easy, right? Simple to do. And yet there's so many things that are organized in a way to influence the opposite behavior, put it off, right? Not go. Yeah. It's useful. So that it's useful for that. You have focus and then you're able to take all of your other sources of influence behind it. One of which is, like you mentioned, meeting with people, to make sure that it happens more regularly.
Yeah. For sure. And any vital behaviors that come to mind that in the in your experience in the church context that you really focused on in your time of leadership or as a young men's president or anything like that?
Yeah, I'll give you a couple of examples. One of the ones that became very apparent was when I was serving as the ward mission leader. We were trying to focus on our ward mission plan and realized that so much of the ward mission plan had been carried out by the ward missionaries, right? So they were going to knock on doors. They were meeting with new people. They were working with missionaries. And we realized that we wanted to have the ward be more engaged in missionary work. So what do we want them to do specifically? We looked at some of the things that Elder Perry had put out, some of the ways that he wanted us to conduct missionary work, and realized kind of woven in between all of the activities there were two behaviors that they it seemed to focus on that jumped out, at least to us. And one was invite, making invitations, inviting people over to your house, inviting people, you know, to have conversations with you, inviting people to church events, but being more of an inviting group. And the other one was testify of the truthfulness of the gospel, and different than you might think, because it's not like sacrament meeting, fast and testimony meeting, where you all stand up and talk from the pulpit. Right? You can do a small testimony just about an experience that you had in Sunday school, something that touched you, a doctrine, a comment that someone made that helps other people see how the gospel operates in different people's lives. And so those were the two that we started with. Said if we can get members to invite and testify. Now, again, just because you've identified that, roll it out, ask people to do it, doesn't mean that they automatically do. You actually have to help them. So standing up from the pulpit and giving a talk about the importance of these two things is not enough. We found that while people were familiar with what a testimony was, they had trouble so many times giving a very short testimony, right? So we had a class where we would bring people in and we'd have a number of different gospel topics. And we'd ask them to pick one of them and create a 60-second testimony, which is really, really quite difficult, right? So how can you deliver something meaningful, a meaningful experience, something that you care about in 60 seconds or less? And then we had them practice it. And we found that the more they practiced it, the more likely they were to go out and actually share it. Right? We had them keep track of how many invites and how many testimonies they made in a week. And most people, before they kept track, thought that they were doing it every day to every person that they met. And they'd come back and they'd have a 3x5 card and they'd just basically be marking off how many times I invited, how many times I bore a testimony of some sort. And they might have five for the whole week, you know, combined. And bringing that to their awareness that I'm not doing it as often as I should, and improving their capacity to do it more effectively, we saw that they could double that in the next week. Right? And really, when it comes to missionary work, Heavenly Father is able to amplify our efforts, but if we aren't exerting ourselves, then it's hard to make missionary work really become a true focus in our lives, right? Because for every person who listens to the gospel, it requires what, I'm trying to remember the data, something like between 5 and 7 contacts. So how do we accelerate to the point of 7, right? So we want to get more quickly to the point of 5 to 7. Right now, people are sitting right around 2 to 3. And so by focusing on these vital behaviors, you had more people out in the neighborhood. We also found that there was one other behavior that had to go along with that, which was befriending, saying hi, waving, you know, checking in with your neighbors, knowing who they were on both sides. And those three made a big difference in our missionary efforts.
So a few things you said there that I want to underscore is really the invite and testify portion, like going back to the vital behaviors, a ward mission leader, you know, yearly they may set a goal of baptisms, right? And to baptize somebody, man, that seems like such a daunting task. But by minimizing it to just the vital behaviors of we want to invite and testify. And so let's think of some behaviors that we can do that lead to inviting and testifying, right?
Right. That's exactly right. Those are the behaviors, right? The invite and testify. Now, how do we encourage people to do it?
Right.
So the ward in our case was comfortable with, familiar with, used to the ward mission and those involved in the ward mission is doing all that work. And then, so we were trying to work through them saying, how do we get them to do that work?
Perfect. And what did you, how did that transpire? What did you do to do that?
It was interesting. It's tougher than you think, right? Because you only get people once a week, to be able to reinforce that. And they have all of their different Sunday school classes already set. So we had had, like a 4-week course to help people become better member missionaries. And, then supplemented some of that with what was being said in sacrament meeting and what was happening in the beginning of elders' quorum or priesthood opening exercises and with Relief Society and Young Men, Young Women, mm-hmm. forcing it. And so some people wouldn't show up. It was hard to get them there consistently. We had the right mechanism in place, but then executing on that was a little tough. So we saw some marginal increases. And then it took a little while before we got a critical mass and a lot of people started doing it. But we had, for example, one group of people who realized that their neighbor, who was a member of the church, hadn't been to church in a long time. They started befriending him, introducing him to one another. And in about a month's period of time, that person came back to church and is now coming pretty regularly and now trying to stop smoking and do a whole lot of other things. So back on the path. It works for both baptisms and reactivation. We had another lady in our ward that's exactly how she got contacted, and it took a little longer than everyone thought. It took about a year of contacting and fellowshipping, and she got baptized, and we had another little girl who also got baptized because of that.
Wow. So, That's great.
Yeah. We did something similar when I was bishop. We focused on an outcome. We wanted people to be more deeply converted. And so we looked at the conversion process, you know, as outlined in Helaman chapter 15 in the first, I guess it's 6, 7, and 8, those verses, first part of the chapter. And so there was, you know, a sequence of events. You can look at scripture study and prayer lead to faith. And then you have like the Nephites and we're talking about the anti-Nephi Lehis, I guess there, that became unshakable in the thing where which they were made free. And so how could you create that for your ward? And how do we help them focus on those behaviors and see how they would affect, make it easier for them? We had activities that they could do, things that we designed as a bishopric that we gave out, how we taught about those things. And it was interesting to see what would happen. You know, we had an increase in sacrament meeting attendance. People were coming more often, which for us correlated also with an increase in those having a current temple recommend, those who had the possibility of having a temple recommend, having a current temple recommend, and home teaching. So you could see all those metrics that you track in a bishopric and a ward start to move. Yeah.
Oh, cool. Now, what about in your experience as young men's president? Any specific principles that you've drawn upon to create influence, or maybe conversations you've had, or things like that?
Yeah. Those are. For the young men's president, I think the skills that I've used more often with the young men's presidency and than with the young men themselves have been more around the crucial conversations skills. How do you bring up something that's really tough and risky? You know, so we had one of the boys who wasn't coming as often. So go and talk to him about it. He's a little bit shy and doesn't want to bring up all the reasons why he's not coming. How do you create the safety in which he can open up and tell you he doesn't like the people in his quorum? And that's a tough one. We've got an interesting dynamic and kind of a population in the neighborhood where I live. So we have a lot of students, about 40-ish And there have been at times up to 50-ish% student population in our ward. So that means that the young men's, young women's program are a little bit smaller. You have a huge nursery, and then as you start to march towards young men and young women, you start to see smaller classes. So we have 6 priests, 7 teachers, and 6 deacons right now, which is a pretty good size for us. And it's not as big as some wards in Utah County. Mm-hmm. So we get a little greater opportunity to talk with the boys. And it also means that in such a small group, you have one boy whose interests are a little bit different, and they might not connect with someone else. There might not be somebody else in that group that has a lot of the same interests or, you know, thinks exactly the same way. So how do you get them to open up and express those so that you can fix it? One of the things that happens in the church, in quorums, in all kinds of different settings, is that we as a people, and LDS people, are so concerned with being nice and being kind that we often talk ourselves out of the tougher conversations that need to happen around bringing these things to light, because that might hurt someone's feelings. But if you can't make it visible, you can't work on it.
It's just there's all sorts of elephants in the room that nobody wants to talk about because they'd rather just be nice, right?
Right. Right. So the most common thing that I see in the church, and it's one of the least effective things, you know, I have a concern with one person in my quorum or one person in my presidency. And so I bring everybody together and I give them a lecture on why this thing shouldn't be happening and what we need to do differently. And well, so 5 of the people in the room have never done that. And so they're thinking, why does he have me in here? What's he talking about? Right. And there's only one person who's actually done it. And unfortunately what they're thinking is, why am I in here? And why is he talking about this? Because we haven't been direct about it. Excuse me. And so that's been really useful for the young men working with them, is this whole idea of how do you create free flow or exchange of meaning, especially around things that are sensitive. You know, are you planning on going on a mission? And where's your testimony? And have you been able to get your own testimony rather than rely on your parents? And your level of activity, although you think it means that you're an active member, would be deemed as totally inactive by most other people in the ward. And how do we come together on some of those common ideas and then create a plan to move to action?
Yeah, for sure. And that brings to mind, you know, this idea of in relation to home teaching, where, you know, home teaching percentage isn't good. And so the leader, the elders quorum president, feels like he needs to go into the quorum meeting and, you know, pound the lectern and demand better results when, you know, half the room is doing their home teaching maybe. And they're thinking, geez, you know, what's going on? Like I'm doing just fine, you know, where the having a one-to-one conversation is truly a skill, like, especially when stakes are high, you know, and the chance of awkwardness is high, to have that conversation is very difficult. And so it does take some practice, some applied skill or strategies to really make that a meeting where both parties leave feeling uplifted and like, you know, we're on the right track.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, that whole idea in Doctrine and Covenants for proving betimes with sharpness is a tricky one. Because while we know that sharpness actually means clarity, too often in the church, people feel that clarity feels pretty sharp. And so we ought to move away from that, right? So they start to multiply the number of words that they put out there before they correct somebody. And that'll make it easier for them to hear, or they soften it. And, you know, then it really doesn't communicate the full extent of their concern.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that is an interesting balance. How do you show them that you love them, right? And at the same time, be very direct and candid. And the key to that, we found in our work in organizations, but also is true, and this will ring true as you think about it in the gospel sense, is you have to establish mutual purpose and mutual respect. And people don't become defensive because of what you're saying. They become defensive because of why they think you're saying it. It's not the content, it's your intent. And we spend so much time trying to mold the content, soften it up, and change it so that it's palatable rather than bolstering our intent, right? Making that explicit. We have usually positive intent for bringing things up. We're not bringing up concerns with home teaching with Elders Quorum members because we hate them. It's because we're concerned about them. We're concerned about the families. So how do you make that concern evident in a way that shows other people up front, this is what I care about? So making that explicit part of the conversation, starting your positive with your positive intent, can be a huge benefit, you know, when you're dealing with sensitive subjects.
Yeah. You know, it reminds me of, you know, I don't know if I mentioned this to you prior to the interview, but I'm currently serving as bishop in my ward. And from time to time, there is a, you know, whether it's an auxiliary leader who's frustrated with maybe some of her, his or her counselors, maybe it's a, you know, just a member that's having a difficult time with somebody else. And so they come to the bishop sort of wanting to vent a little bit, but also seek some guidance on how to use it. And they'll go into a explanation of, you know, this person did this and it really made me feel like this. And I didn't mean for it to do this and that and this. And they go on and tell me this explanation of why they're doing this. And I usually stop and say, well, why don't you just go tell the person exactly what you told me? Because in that conversation, they're establishing, you know, mutual purpose and mutual respect, but they're doing it with a third party. Where if they took those same words and just and pointed them towards the individual that they're struggling with, more than likely the person will say, oh, wait, I didn't mean that. Like, and then you have something to talk about, right? And so how would you suggest in those conversations, what are some basic ways somebody can establish mutual purpose and mutual trust?
I think if you look at what you're trying to accomplish in the long term, right? So so many times I'm working with other auxiliaries on projects or initiatives or activities, you know, to get things done. And they do something that bugs me or that doesn't give me what I want, right? That'd be the kind of situation that there is some sort of gap in expectations. I was expecting this and I'm experiencing something different than that. So one of the things that you do when you go and talk to them is say, hey, can I talk to you about something that, you know, I don't even know if you might not be aware of. And I think if we can bring it up, it would help us work more effectively together as we try to solve home teaching assignments for youth with high priests, for example. And so say, well, my intent here is to bring something to your attention, and I think that it'll help us be more effective in this way. And with that framework, it sounds better than if I just come to the high priest group leader and say, man, how come you can't get my youth assigned a home teaching assignment? They're struggling, right? Because then it's possible for him to feel like it's an attack. I'm not trying to attack him, but he can't see what it is, right? So how do you make that explicit? You infuse it. You state your positive intent up front.
Yeah, you know, the positive intent is so powerful, and in conjunction with what you said is, and I don't know the exact verbiage, but, you know, drawing attention to that gap of expectations, where if someone goes forward and just expresses, and basically you go within the intention of comparing intent, where you say, you know, what's your goal? Like, what do you want to come out of this activity or this thing that we're struggling with? And they say, well, you know, I want to be successful, that people enjoy, or where testimonies are built and people walk away with the Spirit. And you can say, you know what, that's my intent too. We're on the same page, but I have this gap here. Let's just talk about this gap. Now that we know we have a mutual understanding, a mutual goal, let's just talk about the gap and see why it's making me think you have a different intent, right?
That's another way of looking at it. You make it explicit and ask what they're doing or compare those and say, hey, that's what we really want. I think this moves us away from that, or this isn't as helpful.
Yeah, for sure. There's a lot to talk about, and I could talk about this stuff all day. And obviously, you know, Vital Smarts, and you're familiar with this process. They put on, you know, day long, week long trainings where you're practicing this stuff and really, you know, trying to understand the concepts, the skills, and the steps to take. So it's definitely not going to be clear within one simple interview. And so I always encourage people to go out and you know, read these books and understand the principles. And man, they truly have changed my life to be a better communicator as a leader. You know, when two parties are having a disagreement, whether that's a marriage or two auxiliary leaders, something, it allows me to step back and say, okay, now I at least have some ideas and skills I can approach it with. Doesn't mean I'm going to hit a home run here, but at least I have something to do other than just saying, you know, just get over it and just be happy, you know, and that's not going to help anybody just by saying kind of superficial phrases like that. So, but let me shift gears a little bit to just your experience in the Young Men's Presidency. As from time to time, I do these interviews about how a person leads in their calling. And maybe I just want to talk about the practical sides of your calling. How long have you served as Young Men's President?
It's been about 2 years now.
Okay, cool. So you got it all figured out, right? Nice. So what's your typical week like? Meetings, Sunday morning until Saturday evening. What does that look like?
So Sunday morning, we have our ward council or our PEC in the morning. So I would go to that. We have 1 o'clock church. So that one's at 10, goes from 10 to 11. And then we have our young men's meeting from 11:30 to 12. And then the 3-hour block from 1 to 4. After the 3-hour block, there's sometimes, you know, different activities that we're engaging, either Bishop's Youth Discussion, Fast Offering Collection. Sometimes we have once a month, you know, Bishop's Youth Council. So those would be directly after the meeting. Then home, family time, Monday, Tuesday, you know, regular types of activities with family work. Wednesday would be our young men's activities. We have mutual meeting at 7. And then we may have another activity in the middle of the week. Like, for example, this week we had young men's this week, but we have a service project that's happening tomorrow at the Food and Care Coalition.
Cool.
So then that rounds out the whole week. And
cool.
Yeah, we'll sometimes have, every once in a while, have young men drop in and want to play sports or games or something like that. But usually that's how it goes.
Okay, great. Now, think if you were to get in a time machine and go back 2 years and talk with yourself just going into the calling, any nuggets or, you know, concise direction you would say after 2 years, I've learned this and make sure not to make this mistake or focus on this or that. What would you tell yourself?
Yeah, that's a great question. One of the things that I'm reminded of over and over how important it is the planning that, and with young men's, it's an interesting thing because it's really easy to make this an adult-led program. And as they move closer to the priest quorums, it ought to be more of a boy-led program. And getting them to plan out a calendar in advance has been so helpful. So when we haven't done it, we've suffered. When we have done it, it's just made everything go so much more smoothly. So what I'm talking about here is some kind of system where the boys are thinking about in advance the types of activities that they're going to engage in for their mutual and having a variety of activities. Otherwise, you have the default of show up, not sure what we're going to do, let's play basketball. And so being clear at each level of young men's what they should be focused on. With the deacons, they should be focused on scouts. Right, so they've had all their scout activities, and we have the focus of trying to get scouts to the point of getting their eagle right around the time they're 14, between 14 and 15. So the teachers have kind of a split focus. They're somewhat focused on scouts, eagle projects, and earning some last-minute merit badges to get them all caught up. And then they're also focused on the spirituality aspect of, you know, duty to God and then career development. Once they get to priests, we do very little scouts at all. It's mostly mission prep, career development. And so when you think about that and you sit down and say, now what activities help us to accomplish that? We found that useful. So the way we do it, when we do it consistently, is to say every second month of the quarter, we sit down and we plan for the next quarter. So we always have 4 months of activities planned. And that's been useful because when we get to a week and we say, okay, this week we wanted to do this. All right, so-and-so, what are you going to do? Okay, who's going to take this assignment? We got to call, make reservations. Who's doing that? And so we can plan out in advance and or say, that's not going to work. Great, what are we going to do instead? But it allows us to have a variety of different activities because we have that focus, right? What are we going to do this? How are we going to work duty to God in there? What would be a good mission prep activity? And we make all the suggestions, put all the suggestions on a brainstorm list and then map it out. And it's been really good when we've been able to do that consistently. So I would tell myself first and foremost, that's been, when we're able to do it, one of the best things that can happen.
Great. That's awesome advice for sure. Any technology you use to coordinate or keep track of things, plan, whether it's an app or simple online app or.
Well, you're going to think this is a little bit old school because most of the technology that works best for the boys is actually paper and pencil on the wall. I mean, connecting with them for notification through texting is great, but if you want to track duty to God, if it's in an app somewhere, they don't see it. We don't see it. Right? They don't remember it. But if we keep it on the wall and they can mark it off and they can see what they're doing, it just works better for the humans.
Nice. Analog. I like it.
Yeah.
that's a good tip because, you know, with youth, you kind of just make the assumption that, you know, they won't be engaged unless it's something like, you know, electronical or on their phone or whatever it is. So that's great.
I've also found, I guess this kind of crossing the line between the last two questions you asked. It's a little bit of both and really neither of either.
Okay.
One of the things that I found with the young men is that they're capable of doing a lot and sometimes more than we think. For example, last year we had the missionaries come and talk to our young men about door approaches and missionary work, and they practiced their door approaches and then went out with the missionaries and knocked doors to find out who people were in our neighborhood, fill out the ward map kind of thing. It was a great experience, and we were talking about that, and the ward mission leader at the time said, that sounds wonderful. We really need something like that for all of our members. We ought to get the missionaries to come in and teach our members how to do that same thing. They said, well, you know, our young men just went through this experience. Why don't we have the young men teach the combined adults what they learned? They said, no, couldn't do it. What if they screw up? They're not ready. I mean, these are adults. They're good for this, but I don't know if they can do that. We had 5 young men at the time, and we could break the hour up into 10-minute slots, which is just perfect, actually, for learning and development. You know, if you're thinking about brain rules, you ought to take an hour worth of material and break it into 6 10-minute lecturettes. So it was perfect for us. Each boy got 10 minutes, and they did a fabulous job. If you give them a little guidance, you know, a little bit of an outline, they didn't know necessarily how to put together a teaching outline. They didn't think. But then they realized from all the experience with teaching one another that they were better at it than they thought. And they did a powerful job. And it was better than the missionaries coming in to do it because it was reinforced for the boys.
That's a great idea. Great experience.
Yeah. So many times we rob people of experiences because we do it for them, right? So the elders quorum president who goes out and home teaches because someone else doesn't do it denies that person, you know, exposure to A, meaningful spiritual work, and B, the opportunity to grow and develop in their capacity to do that work. So if we give them guidance and support, I think that the young man especially, and this would also extend to young women, but the young people of the church can do more than we anticipate. The one thing that I've learned over and over again that's, you know, more of a, more clear for me now than it was 2 years ago is that we typically hear people talk about the Aaronic priesthood as a preparatory priesthood. And so all of what we do is preparing you for when you'll be bishop, for when you'll be in a leadership position. And we don't focus as much on, you're in a leadership position right now. You run a quorum. You've got keys. Right? And you ought to be able to do work today with the Aaronic priesthood that's meaningful, that's significant.
Great point. That's awesome. So really, I usually end most interviews with this question, but as you look back on all your experience in the church and various positions you've served, how do you feel like your role as a leader has made you a better disciple of Jesus Christ?
Oh, yeah, my wife would say that. She would, when I was called to be bishop, I have an interesting background, something you didn't ask about and probably didn't know, and I don't know if Kurt, our mutual friend, had shared this with you. I joined the church when I was 18, almost 19.
Oh, wow.
So didn't grow up and went on a mission in the in the Quito, Ecuador mission, came back, got married. We were pregnant with our first boy when I was called to be bishop. So I was 27 years old when I was called to be bishop.
Wow.
And it was a big sacrifice. I remember my wife, Margaret, when we found out that I was being called to be bishop, just started crying. I mean, just big tears down her face. And she sustained the stake president in the calling and sustained me in my calling, which was a huge testimony building for me. I knew that she would do tough things and what it meant to her. But it was at a tough time. And I asked her several times and probably several years later than that how she got through it, because now she's kind of like a single mom. I travel quite a bit, so I was traveling during the week and being bishop on the weekend. She was sitting alone with our oldest and then second oldest child for those 5.5 years. And she said, it's okay that you're up there, because when you come home, you're better. And you'd see all of these problems, challenges, all of these opportunities that people are wrestling with. And vicariously, as you lived through that experience, you became a better husband and dad. And so that was nice to know that one of the biggest impacts of having served is it allows you to be better. And I found the same thing. I mean, it became very apparent when I was bishop, but I found the same thing when I was Gospel Essentials teacher, or when I was serving in the primary or as a clerk, is that somehow it touches you. It gives you this direct experience with the gospel in a way that allows your capacity to expand your testimony, to be enriched. And it was just really powerful to see it. And during that time, especially magnified, but during all of the other opportunities to serve, it expands your discipleship, I think, in those ways, because you see things, internalize it in a different way than you would if you were just a passive parishioner.
Great interview. I hope you take the time as a leader and really figure out your vital behaviors. What is it that you can focus on that will have the greatest impact on your end goal? What are some simple activities that you can encourage those you lead to do that'll cause real change to take place in your quorum or ward? If you haven't done so yet, be sure to check out the Food Order Reference Guide that is now available on Leading LDS. This is a tool that makes filling out food order forms easier and more effective for bishops or Relief Society presidents or anybody else that has been tasked to fill out food order forms. It makes a great way to say thank you to your bishop and or Relief Society president and helps them perform their calling more effectively. Until next time, be a leader and not a calling.